Welcome to EIR Talks. On July 24th, 2001, broadcasting over the internet, Lyndon LaRouche, presidential pre-candidate for the 2004 election, before an audience of 250 people in Washington, D.C. and at the United Nations, declared the current world financial system in an unsalvageable collapse. This week's EIR Talks will continue with the questions and answers from that broadcast.
The concern is the Islamic populations in Central Asia and the neglect that they are suffering and the economic problems that they are going through as a consequence of the collapse of the Soviet Union. How can we address those, and how will that go with the land bridge, Eurasian land bridge concept?
The latest leg in that is the agreement reached at Shanghai, the Shanghai Cooperation Council, which was a new institution established of the chief sponsorship by Russia's President Putin and China's President Jiang Zemin. This is on the first level, is a security agreement. And as you know, Uzbekistan was brought into this partnership during this period. So it's now been expanded from the Shanghai Five to a larger number of people. Essentially, this is cross-references agreements between Russia and India and concern Russia and India. It also cross-references China's relationship to Iran and Russia's relationship to Iran and India's relationship to Iran. It cross-references the eager efforts between the President of Pakistan and the Prime Minister of India to have an ongoing negotiation which will bring peace between these two countries, both of which are concerned, deeply concerned, about the security of Central Asia. And both are concerned about relations with Iran and the security of Iran. If these nations are able to combine their concerns as the Shanghai Cooperation Council with the other partners of these same partners, then you will have a very solid, a problem-ridden, yes, but solid effort to bring stability. Now, in this area of Central Asia, as you know, if we include projects such as large-scale water projects, because, for example, take the Aral Sea is a perfect example of this. If we rebuild the Aral Sea, if we better manage the water of Central Asia, these areas, which are now traditionally poverty-stricken areas, can become significant areas of growth. And generally, there's nothing better for peace and stability and security than some prospect of happiness and growth in the area. So these things are in reach. But more significantly, remember that in 1998, after Gore failed, the collapse of the hedge fund, the long-term capital management hedge fund, that you had someone who Gore didn't like became the prime minister, Primakov. And Primakov did organize among China, India, and Russia in this direction, and also with Central Asian states in the same direction. Putin has revived this in a very effective way. Let me just add one thing to it, which is significant also, a factor. China had been trying to deal with the United States under Clinton and with Gore, especially from, I would say, 1996-97 within the WTO agreement arrangement. Because there were people in China who believed, still then, but no more, that the short-term or medium-term interest of China was to export China products, usually cheap labor products or other things like that, into the United States market. Well, as you may have observed, the U.S. market as an import of last resort has been collapsing of late. As a matter of fact, the rate of collapse is accelerating right now. So as a result of that, China has realized that it cannot rely upon the external market for cheaply produced goods into the United States and Western Europe. That market is collapsing and will collapse to maybe 50% of what it had been formerly. Therefore, how is China going to keep its economy stable? China will now have to rely upon more emphasis on internal improvements, especially in basic economic infrastructure. Therefore, when Jiang Zemin went to Moscow, there was a renewal of the emphasis upon cooperation among these countries for internal improvements. There was some uncertainty about the improvement of the relations between India and China for a period recently. But most recently, as the Chinese government has expressed in a statement publicized in the Times of India, where it was publicized to make for that effect, is that there's now much closer cooperation or prospective of cooperation between China and India. And this also coincides with the meeting between the President of Pakistan and the Prime Minister of India. So all of these things are tending to come together. If this cooperation occurs, then you have another factor. Europe is starving, Western Europe. It's not starving yet, but it's the process of starving. All of Europe depends chiefly upon the economy of Germany. The economy of Germany carries most of the rest of Europe on its back, at least by a margin. Over the years, for the past 10 years, the economy of Germany, which was largely a high-technology export-based economy, has been collapsing under the influence of Mitterrand and Thatcher and Bush and the policies left behind. So now Germany and the rest of Western Europe are in deep trouble. All of Western Europe is in deep trouble. All of the economies are collapsing. Look at, if you read the daily reports about the tax increases, the cuts in this and so forth, these economies are collapsing. The value of the euro is collapsing. The question of whether the euro will be converted on January 1st as proposed is doubt now. It's a very unstable situation. Europe desperately needs major markets for its European type of exports. Exports principally from places like Japan, Germany, Italy, France, and so forth. If Europe is committed to cooperation with this European, Shanghai Cooperation Council and the other Eurasian blocs, that will mean there will be a significant amount of long-term investment in the development of Central Asia. Under those circumstances, then the aborted development of the parts of the Soviet Union in Central Asia will be improved, particularly if the agreements with Tajikistan, which are very important in this pattern, if those agreements come off successfully.
I'd like to ask Dr. Ali Mohammed. He is the Minister of Health for the Nation of Islam and a key leader in the Coalition to Save DC General Hospital, to step up to the microphone. Good afternoon, Dr. Mohammed.
And let me please extend the greetings to you, Mr. LaRouche. And actually, I'm not going to ask a question about D.C. General Hospital. What I was wondering, what is your take on the recent conference convened in Lusaka, Zambia? I think there were 41 or 43 heads of state of African governments who essentially have agreed that there should be an African Union for economic and political reasons. What's your take on it? What do you think the potential for progress is in that kind of an arrangement, and what are the pitfalls that need to be avoided? And then additionally, at the conference in Germany in May, there were some representatives from Egypt, and Egypt would be a link in the Eurasian land bridge into Africa. What are the implications of a federated African republic linking with the Eurasian and land bridge project? Thank you.
Well, on the question of the latter part on Egypt, the leadership in Egypt on the land bridge is well known, well documented. This is established. The major problem at this point, of course, is the threat of a war in the Middle East coming from an Israeli attack on its Arab neighbors and victims. If that can be avoided, what I see is everything is go for that. The problem is this Israeli-Palestinian war situation. Otherwise, this would be go. It might be modest, it might not be as vigorous as I would like, but they mean business, and there's a vision there. And Egypt is a country which is capable of doing that. You know, Egypt is a very old country. It's a few thousand years old. Its best years come back 5,000-6,000 years, long before the rest of us were out of the mud, so to speak. So it's a proud country and has a long tradition, and it does have an elite which is capable of doing things. It has problems. on the question of the other African countries, we always keep coming back to this, of trying to get unity among some African states, particularly from sub-Saharan Africa, to offset the terrible oppression they get when they're taken on one at a time. That is, an African nation today, sub-Saharan Africa, has no chance whatsoever one-on-one against the IMF and what that represents. No chance whatsoever. Therefore, any African leader who has any sense is going to try to call these kind of conferences and get something going, where they get a group of nations. For some time, up until recently, Nigeria was the key nation for that, for Africa. South Africa had a special role, but the problem in South Africa is so much of the territory is owned by Anglo-American and other European and American swindlers that there's very little left over to control for the Africans actually to control. That's the problem. But Nigeria, which was inspired to form one nation by the United Arab Republic, by Nasser's proposal, said we must unify for strength. And so instead of having three nations, as the British had intended, they formed one called Nigeria. It's the most populous part, and of course the Nigerian population cuts into much, is linked to much of the population of sub-Saharan Africa. Nigeria has been essentially crushed. Nigeria is not in the position that it was a few years ago. Most of the nations we're referring to that were at that conference have been crushed. They're fighting for their lives. And it's a losing fight, the way the game is stacked down. My hope on such things is that the very discussion themselves, these discussions, tend to keep the idea of a system of cooperation among sub-Saharan African states on the table. And as long as the fight is continued, we don't give up. You know, sometimes you fight a long war. Long wars are not good ideas. Short wars are the best wars, especially if you win them. But long wars are not a good idea. It wears people down. It takes their resources away from them. It weakens their will. It induces corruption and demoralization. But it's a long fight. We have to continue it because there's no hope for Africa until we can establish that sort of thing. I don't think that the agreements, the attempts made there, will be successful in and of themselves. But what I think, on the other side, is that the very attempt to maintain the search for such agreements keeps the spark of life in the effort. And right now, that's essential. Africa's on the edge. We might get lucky. We might be able to win a fight or two here and there. For example, the issue of the disease fight in Africa. It seems to be where the most effective organization presently is on the pharmaceutical issue of the right of African nations to have affordable drugs to meet their needs, their public health needs, such as on the question of AIDS and so forth. But these issues are valuable. You keep the fight alive, but I see no chance of winning unless we can win the fight in the global area. I don't think Africa can win the fight locally. But I think the effort to keep the flag flying, like the effort to keep the American flag flying during the darkest part of our Revolutionary War, is a commendable effort.
Lynn, we have a question here from the Democratic Party. The question is, to accomplish the goal of Democrats regaining control of both the House and the Senate in 2002, and the White House in 2004, if not sooner, as part of the battle of restoring true democracy to the people away from the GOP, isn't it more important to be united with the Democratic Party than oppose it, or to oppose other progressive groups? Especially when fully united, we are more effective and in a better position to do the necessary cleaning housework for the benefit of the majority of the people versus the few.
You have a story from the Old Testament about Gideon and Gideon's army. And I don't know how good the story is. It's Old Testament, and some people might want to swear by it or some swear at it. But the fact is that when you allow unity to destroy you, that is, for the sake of unity, you fail to do what you must do. Unity isn't worth anything. You know, how like the history of parties in the United States. You had the beginning, you had the Federalist Party, which was a fairly good party when it started under George Washington. Then things turned a little bit sour. The French problem and the British problem came in. About 1797, the Federalist Party began to be corrupted by British and French agents, variously, especially British agents. So that by the beginning of the century, 1800, you had a guy who was a likely winner of the presidential nomination in the Electoral College was a traitor by the name of Aaron Burr. At that point, Alexander Hamilton used his influence to swing the Electoral College vote to Jefferson. Now, Hamilton was not too complimentary to Jefferson. He said he wasn't worth much anymore, but at least he wouldn't sell the country down the drain the way Burr would. We had, and the Jefferson government, the two administrations, was pretty much a disaster on policy. Madison, who had been a significant leader earlier, was also a disaster. Both were controlled by people who were just plain British agents. In the process, you had a revolt called the Warhawks. Out of the Warhawks came a new political formation led by people like Matthew Carey, who was the heir, political heir of Benjamin Franklin, a publisher in Philadelphia. And they formed what became known as the Whig Party, the American Whig Party. The American Whig Party took power with President Monroe and John Quincy Adams. Then you had a treasonous party organized by Martin Van Buren, who was the putative bastard son of Aaron Burr, a banker. Andrew Jackson was the president. The United States was again betrayed and destroyed. The cause of slavery was revived by the Democratic Party, which was the party of treason and racism until Roosevelt came along in his election. So then we had a formation of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party was to save the nation. The Republican Party saved the nation, but the problem with the Republican Party, you had New York Republicans, and New York Republicans generally weren't human. So they were also treasonous. You couldn't tell the difference between a treasonous Democrat and a treasonous New York Republican. They're pretty much the same thing. Teddy Roosevelt was typical of that kind of thing. Wilson was an actual racist. He was the guy who reorganized the Ku Klux Klan in the United States from the White House. He's called a great Democrat. Coolidge was a racist from the North. A terrible fellow. Then Roosevelt changed the Democratic Party despite the Democratic Party and made it the party of the people. So the Roosevelt Party was good. Now we struggle along, and Kennedy, in a sense, by his election, revived the Democratic Party. And Johnson, who had his shortcomings, nonetheless did a lot of good things, including the Civil Rights Bill that Al Gore tore up. A racist bill. The tearing up the Civil Rights Bill was a racist action, supported by Gore. You want me to support a racist policy? I won't do it. It's wrong. So now we have two parties, two Democratic parties. We have the Gore Party, and we have the Roosevelt Party. And some people in the Roosevelt Party say you have, that is, people who agree with Franklin Roosevelt in his tradition and John Kennedy's tradition, and say, no, isn't it better to have a party that wins for the good than to have a party that is united for the no good? You know, they have this thing, this socialist, Eugene Debs, said it's better to vote for what you want and lose than to vote for what you don't want and win. And that's what people got in the last election. They voted for what they didn't want, and they got it. So the issue now is the people. The issue is not the party. The issue is the people. To which part of the U.S. population, to what parts, should the Democratic Party be committed? Should it be committed to the lower 80% of the family income brackets who have been looted all these years? Should it be committed to the cause of restoring industry? Should it be committed to the restoring regulation, the way that Carla tore up? Should we have a guaranteed fair price on energy supplies for people? Should we have a health care system for people, not for profit, but for people? So well, the problem here is the Democratic Party has turned away from the people. My view is the Democratic Party must restore itself to the Franklin Roosevelt legacy of the general welfare and must do as Franklin Roosevelt did and search out and reach out to the people and mobilize the people to defend themselves. As I've said before, the problem with the American voter generally is the voter no longer votes for what he wants. He votes for a handout from the guy who thinks he thinks will deliver it. He goes to the back door of the slave owner's house and says, I'll vote for you if you give me a favor. He goes to the back door and says, don't give me my freedom, says the slave, just give me some reparations. You can keep me in slavery as long as you keep feeding me with reparations. And that's the way the American voter behaves, because they have lost their sense that they control this nation. They don't see themselves as citizens anymore. They see themselves as human cattle who have to beg like serfs for handouts from their master. And the Democratic Party says it represents what? What does Al Fromm say he represents? What does Al Gore say he represents? Does he say he represents the American people? He does not. He says he represents the middle. What's the middle? It's the less than upper 20% of the family income brackets. It's the suburbanite vote. The ones who have no principle, the ones who are for free trade, the ones who are for cutting health care, the ones for who are supporting some of these energy policies that are killing us. Don't unite, try to unite around a group, a clubhouse. Unite around the people. This country needs a party that will lead the people, a party that represents the people and the interests of the people. A party that will tell the people what the situation is, what needs to be done about it. We'll debate the issue. We'll not go along to get along, but we'll tell the truth instead. The American people up there, I'm convinced, if they think that there's somebody they can support who might get a little clout, who will actually represent them, they're waiting for that leadership. They're not waiting for Senator Lieberman to lead them down the road to culture, together with the moral majority, when the issue is a crushing economic crisis in the United States. And Lieberman says economics is not the issue. Economics is the issue. It's also the moral issue. Health care is an economic issue. It's a moral issue. Energy prices are a moral issue. Economic jobs are a moral issue. And that's where the problem lies. Unity of the party for the sake of unity. That's what they did in the Roman mob, charging into the Colosseum. And to keep unity among the mob, they would put thumbs down when the lions were eating the Christians. That's not morality.
I'd like to take another question from our live audience. And the person I'd like to call to the microphone is someone who has become extremely well known here in Washington, D.C., also from the Coalition to Save D.C. General Hospital, our own warrior nurse, Charlene Gordon. Charlene, are you there? There we go.
Good afternoon, and hello, how are you, Mr. LaRouche? Nice hearing from you. As you know, my name is Charlene Gordon. You know I'm the warrior nurse. And I'm still fighting, and I'm still wanting the inevitable to happen now. And I will continue to fight and be at war with those who have killed our children here. My anguish is that, as you say, Congress, Democrats, or Republicans, they know this is wrong, and they still sit back waiting for that prince or princess to step forward to open the issue of D.C. General and what is to be done. I have met senators, representatives, my cousins, and everybody else around here, and they still all know this is wrong, but they still sit back. Since the Wicked Witch of the East has died on the last day of our job, July the 14th, when she hit her head, possibly herniated and died, we still have this fight ahead of us. We are slowly doing something, but the inability to tell the truth via the media and the witches of TV or radio is very enabling to our cause. My people, who all are poor, remains in a coma in this area about their future lives. Even our ministers in their churches are in a coma about their people's lives. How do we change this? What do we do that we have not already done? This is no win. This no win all the time is hard on the morale for the people who want the DC general back. We have faction groups here who refuse to join with us to fight for the hospital as a unit. How do we get them in this fight for the common good of man? What do we do to wake up my people, my poor people? We have to start somewhere, then go on to the global issue of saving human lives. If we lose this, we're telling the masses they can't win against tyranny and oligarchy who supposedly controls this. What do we do to save this? How do we wake these people up? Do you know? And when are you coming to the United States, the New World? Thank you.
We will continue in a moment with more of the questions and answers from the July 24th webcast. To replay the show or read the transcript, visit LaRouchePub.com. That's www.LaRouchePub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We will now continue with more of the questions and answers from the July 24th webcast.
All right. Fine. There's a very simple problem here. And you face the problem, we face the problem, I face the problem constantly with our organizers all the time. And to be very frank, you see that the greatest, one of the greatest evils in the United States is typified by the case of Dale Carnegie, who some of you heard about, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Now, some people think the way to be effective, it's like the question about the Democratic Party, can't we have party unity? You say, well, we have to have party unity first of all. Well, that's a killer. That means you don't do what you should do. That means you betray the cause. Now, what people say is, it like things like go along to get along, how to win friends and make friends and influence people. You've got to learn to get along. Now that means that if somebody next to you believes something which is absolutely insane, or is supporting something which they ought to know is insane, you don't say, well, maybe you have a point there, but I have a slightly different point. Or maybe we should talk about it. That's not morality. That's not honest politics. That's corruption. Because when you have a system that is killing people, the system functions because people support the system. They say, well, I think it's the thing we should support. But it's killing people, you say. But I think we should support it. I think it will work out. It will never work out, you say. The facts are clear. It's killing people. And you don't want to name it by name, it's wrong. You don't tell the truth. You compromise. And people say, well, if you don't make friends, how are you going to get any support for what you want? So the first thing you have to do is join the party, stick with the party, and make friends. Well, if you join the party on those conditions and make friends on those conditions, you'll never do what's right. And you'll go to your grave buried by your refusal to do what's right. That's what's wrong. What you need in leadership, see, people think leaders are those who reflect the prejudices of the people. Well, people who reflect the prejudices of the people are not leaders. What the people need is leaders who correct the errors of the people, who tell them where they're wrong, but make it stick by proving that it's wrong, by sitting down with them, thrashing it out, arguing it, say, what's the facts? What are the facts here? Look at the facts. I say you're wrong. And the weakness I have in organizing with people is I find a lot of people say they're organizing with me, but they won't tell people the truth. When telling people the truth means telling them that what they're saying is wrong. When you want to talk to a congressman, don't say, please, Mr. Congressman, like me. Maybe do some little thing for me, Mr. Congressman. You say, Congressman, you're wrong. You're wrong. You tell Tom Daschle, Daschle, you're wrong. You got to change. You're wrong. You tell other congressmen, you're wrong. Why didn't you do something about D.C. General? You're wrong. Don't tell me you had a reason for it. You didn't have a reason for it. It was wrong. Let's argue it. Don't tell me you have to go along to get along. Don't tell me about party unity. Don't talk to me about leadership. Let's talk about right and wrong. And you need citizens led by people who will go to a congressman and go to others and say, let's not talk about this go along to get along nonsense. Let's talk about what's right and what's wrong. Let's put the facts on the table and decide who is right. Answer this question, please. How do we save these lives? Because if you don't do it, you're going to kill them. Do you want to kill people, Mr. Congressman? Because if you don't do something about it, you're killing people. And that's what leadership is. Leadership is not this kissy-kissy stuff. Leadership is telling the people when they're wrong. And you should never vote for a leader who doesn't tell you when he thinks you're wrong. Don't trust him. That, Charlene, is the answer.
This is from Japan. It's from someone who I think you know. The question is, Mr. LaRouche, as you know, Japanese Prime Minister Kusumi has announced plans for a kind of shock therapy program to deal with a huge amount of non-performing loans in Japanese banks. As a result, anywhere from 500,000 to 5 million people could be thrown out of work in Japan's so-called lifetime employment system, and the yen could collapse terribly. This might be helpful for the U.S. dollar. The IMF, Mr. Greenspan, and the Bush administration are repeatedly demanding such a thing, but also many Japanese citizens think serious actions like this are needed. What is your view of a shock therapy for the Japanese banks? And what is your proposal for getting rid of those non-performing loans without a yen crash? We don't want to end up like some Asian countries in 1997, but something must be done to address the problem of Japanese banks.
Yeah. Okay, the problem in Japan is this. Japan is under tremendous pressure from the United States, as we all know. It's under pressure to capitulate and destroy itself for the greater glory and comfort of George Bush. Japan doesn't like that. Patriots of Japan generally are very resentful of that, as they should be. But they say, we have to be careful. We're dealing with the United States. We have to be careful. Terrible things can happen to us. But I think you'll find that in Japan there is a current which says this is wrong. We cannot put up with this forever. It's going to change. Now, I think we're talking about a time frame now in practice of 3 to 4 weeks. There are going to be some big changes one way or the other in the world at large during the coming 3 to 4 weeks. Shocking big changes, not little ones. What has to come together, or what is weighing this? You have two things. First of all, the world knows the United States is going to collapse. They know the United States is collapsing. Now, if you are fighting a dangerous foe who's out to crush you, and you know he's about to collapse, you flank him, don't you? You don't take him head on. You flank him. The world is waiting to flank the Anglo-American powers. They're waiting for the crisis to hit a new level, when the situation of the United States and Britain is terribly weak, which a lot of politicians who are with these policies, that is the U.S. IMF policies, are going to be weakened. And then they're going to try to have something pulled together in a timely fashion as an alternative. It's called flanking the situation. I think that this moment, that it may not be ripe for that kind of action. But I think in the long run, Japan has to take that action. Now, in the short run, what the Prime Minister appears to be talking about is obviously an apparent concession to the United States at the expense of great suffering on the part of the Japanese. But, as in war, perhaps there are patriots behind the scenes in Japan who are not thinking about the suffering of the next few weeks, because they've already seen a lot of it, and a lot of it's coming anyway. They may be thinking about positioning themselves to be able to strike at a more opportune moment, which may be a few weeks down the line. There are problems in that part of the world in pulling things together. It's difficult to bring together Japan, Korea, China, Russia, so forth, all at once. It's difficult to bring the nations of Southeast Asia together all at once. It's difficult. There are long-standing conflicts of one kind or another that one-on-one these nations have difficulties in cooperating, at least on a very intimate basis. And they're faced with a situation where they must form a new monetary system and a new economic system for the region, which includes Russia, China, and these other nations. Nations which are not used to cooperating. You see recently, for example, in the case of a textbook published in Japan, there's an effort to create new friction between forces in Japan, including the present Prime Minister, and Korea, on the question of a certain textbook published in Japan, which is a very rather suspicious textbook. So there are difficulties. North Korea has, there are certain difficulties there in bringing this about. China and Japan, things are not easy for cooperation between China and Japan for known reasons. Korea and China have certain conflicts, certain sensitivities, not easy to deal with. So what we're trying to do, in effect, is we're trying to bring together, as in the case of Pakistan and India and so forth, we're trying to bring together nations for cooperation who have many reasons for friction with one another on a one-to-one basis. And thus, the difficulty here is bringing these nations to the point of ripeness of agreement at which they are prepared to act together in a resolute fashion and are able to trust one another in the sense that one is not going to back out on them and leave the rest hanging in the lurch. So I think that's the situation. So therefore, I would not, apart from what I've said, I would not try to call the shot on this proposed action on behalf of PM Kazemi. I would rather say I would wait about 3 or 4 weeks, and I would be looking at what I'm looking at the point that Japan is building relations with partners, at the same time is buying time for building those relations. And I think that Washington is headed, George Bush's Washington, is headed for a shocking surprise in the Far East and elsewhere sometime in the near future.
Lynn, this is a question from Mr. Vladislav Fedorchenko. He is the senior counselor from the mission of the Russian Federation to the United Nations. His question is, Mr. LaRouche, in accordance with UN experts' forecasts in the Economic and Social Survey 2001, an improvement of the world economy is anticipated for 2002, with an expected growth of GWP at about 3% and of world trade at some 6.5%. Could you comment on these forecasts in the context of a need for further reform of the present world financial system and of your ideas on how to do it?
Maybe somebody's counting on hyperinflation to produce growth figures of that type, because that's the only way they'll get them under the present system. I think that any major growth is going to come from... Helga, my wife, in her testimony to the Duma Commission on Economics, referred to the plan which was adopted by the Friedrich List Society in Germany in 1931, a plan submitted by the Dr. Wilhelm Lautenbach, a leading economist and official of the Germany at that time. And he pointed out that it is insane to presume that because of depression conditions or collapse conditions, that one should use austerity as a method of economic management of national economies, that one must do exactly the opposite. One must find a mechanism of public credit, such as national banking credit, and use that credit to fund large-scale infrastructure and other employment projects to expand the economy, to extend the base of production and the base of economic activities within the population, and use that factor of generated growth to build your way out of an economic crisis. Today, the world's policies are in the opposite direction. Cut, 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 cut. The answer is, in the case of Russia in particular, with a vast amount of idle resources and idle manpower included, the obvious thing is to increase employment, to increase public investment in infrastructure and things of that sort, to try to engage foreign partners in joint agreements, partnership arrangements with Russia's creditors, for example, to expand industries, to increase production. We must do the same thing in the United States. We have to get more production. We have to get more investment inside the United States in the public works area. We should have a major 25-year program of public works building modeled upon the kind of thing that Roosevelt did back in the 1930s and during the war. We should be increasing employment, backing up educational programs and so forth to train the labor force, to expand our base, not to cut, 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 cut. Now, if in Russia, as I read it, under President Putin and some other leaders, particularly, of course, I'm well acquainted best with the Russian academy of science people, and their inclination seems to be, and it certainly is mine, it was the kind of thing I discussed with Russians and discussed in Moscow recently in my presence there. What we have to do is have international agreements which create large masses of public credit. That's not necessarily printing money. That's credit, store credit. You could buy it at the store on credit at very low interest rates. That's not inflationary. In order to increase productive employment, to increase the economic basis of employment and output, that's the way to get out. Unless we go that way, the world is now operating below physical economic break-even. Any attempt to maintain present policies ensures there will be no net economic growth in the world economy, but rather collapse in the coming period. So the UNO estimates obviously are politically motivated. People say if you've got to give a positive note, you've got to say pretty words, make people happy, and everything will go right. Make wishes, make wishes, make pretty wishes. And, you know, George Bush, he's great at pretty wishes, and also some bad ones, too. But it's not going to happen that way, but we can make it happen if we establish a new monetary order, new economic cooperation, and establish international credit among nations to begin expanding production, expanding employment, expanding output, real output, not this paper fictitious output of the type that Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan and so forth like. So I think that's the answer. We've got the chance. It's in our hands. I say if the United States would come to its senses, if people in the United States would support me on this issue and force the present government by getting Republicans as well as Democrats in the Congress to back the people on this issue, we could at this time enter into agreements with nations in Eurasia and other nations. We could have a global expansion of program beginning immediately. It might be slow at start, at the beginning, as it was with Roosevelt back in the 1930s, but it will work. And I think we could reach figures like GDP of 3% and so forth. We could reach it very quickly, also in Russia, because you have so much that's idle there. You can put some of it back to work. You can have growth. And, you know, Russia is still a military nuclear superpower, maybe on reduced circumstances, but it's still a superpower. in any nation that's a military superpower has got to got something going for it inside it in the way of productive potential. So I think that there are possibilities for figures like that, but not under the present system.
Lynn, this is a question from Professor Nestor Ojanar. He is a representative of the Macedonian diaspora. Will you please come to the microphone, sir?
Thank you. Good evening. I have the pleasure of participating at the last year's Schiller's Institute conference in Frankfurt, and I talked to you about Macedonia at the time. I find your ideas on the new Bretton Woods quite pragmatic, very plausible. I also have the same opinion on the ideas of the Eurasian Bridge. These are ideas and concepts that can really be realized. The only problem is how to broaden the context of the audience internationally and how to broaden the content also of that audience internationally. Because I really am concerned and convinced now that unless we all do something in this country, United States of America, and in the world, we will be allowing the oligarchical system to carry us all to the abyss to which they seem to be moribund. And I find that these are the ideas that, of course, enriched into the future, can be providing the world with a vision in which we can all live as citizens of the world, that, by the way, was conceived in the mind of Alexander of Macedonia, if you remember, in some ancient times. I have something which is very personal to me. I am a Macedonian, an ethnic Macedonian. I come from the city of Tetovo in Macedonia, in which, as I speak to you now, there rages savage fighting between the Macedonian government forces against the terrorists of ethnic Albanian minorities that have been introduced, as we all know, from Kosovo under the guise of the KLA mafia organization and sponsored, which is obvious to me today and to all of us, logistically, militarily, and now politically, by all the members, if not all, but by the NATO members, by the NATO organization which is there. President Bush was in Kosovo today, and other than being a public relations stunt, all he had to offer to the suffering Macedonian population was the statement which said that the two parties should stop fighting and respect the ceasefire. I spoke with my sister last night in Tetovo, and I could hear on the telephone the rat-tat-tat, the big thud of artillery and mortar fire and machine guns, and she was crying on the phone to me. And I felt rather helpless, as if I were taken out of some surreal world. And I wanted her to leave the town. I wanted her to go to Skopje to my other sister. In Tetovo, I have hundreds of relatives. In Tetovo, I have thousands of dead ancestors. Tetovo is my town. As far as memory goes, ad infinitum to ancient times, Tetovo has been the town of my ancestors. Now it is under siege, under the very noses of NATO. Now, my question to you is this. I read in the recent issue of the New Federalist, in the context of your explanation of the ideas of the New Bretton Woods and the land bridge, Eurasian land bridge, your statement on NATO. And I can't really recall, I don't pretend to quote you, but I can paraphrase you. You said NATO was a joke. You said that NATO was something like an anachronistic oddity. I agree with you. It is a joke, but it is a dangerous joke. As to whether it is an anachronistic oddity, I think it is, and it should not exist, at least not in the form in which it is, and not in the form in which it functions as an instrument of the neocolonialism that comes to the Balkan states, ruins the states among my beautiful, proud Macedonian country, the nation state, ruins its economy, ruins its infrastructure, ruins its everything, and leaves us alone to be killing each other. What is your take on that, Mr. LaRouche? And what can we do to prevent the Brzezinskis of the world, the Kissingers of the world, the Lord Owens of the world to play their favorite games of divide and rule? Thank you.
Well, first of all, it's a very simple problem here. It's a complicated one, but a simple one, elementary. You have an effort was made in 1989 to exploit the collapse of the Comecon system and the Warsaw Pact in order to establish an Anglo-American world empire controlled largely from the oligarchies of the United States, that is the Wall Street, the Southern Strategy crowd, the racist crowd in this country, and also in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, the United Kingdom. Now, these people in behind this had the conception of setting up a new kind of Roman Empire based on the Venetian model of imperial maritime power to run the world through in the interest of a financier oligarchy, to eliminate the sovereignty of nation states, to reduce the population of the world. They celebrated this immediately by the treaty among Thatcher, Mitterrand, and Bush, which was to keep the Germans down and keep the Russians out. And the first thing they did was to destroy Iraq, which had been faithfully following orders from Bush, and Bush turned on them on the orders of Margaret Thatcher and attacked Iraq. And Saddam Hussein was much astonished that his good buddy, George Bush, should turn on him in that fashion. And once they'd gotten through with butchering Iraq for a while, then they turned on the Balkans immediately and started wars in the Balkans. Now, Balkan wars are an old story. They usually precede world wars. We had Balkan wars in the before World War I, Balkan wars afterward. It's a celebration of the old fight with the Ottoman Empire. Balkan wars, which have been used to destroy Europe from within for a long time. In this case of the Kosovars, I know a good deal about the history of Albania because I'm an older man and come from those generations, and I know a few things about these things. I also know about drug running. I also know about organized crime. I also know who Madeleine Albright is and was. I know who her father is. I know who Condoleezza Rice's teacher, her father, was, Joseph Korbel. They're both close to Brzezinski. They worked with a British crowd to create a mess. Clinton, in the course of the war against Yugoslavia, had said in a speech in San Francisco thereafter that he was against carving up the Balkans into microstates for preserving states, bringing about peace, and once peace was established, to contribute even-handedly, without fear or favor, to the common interest of all of the states in rebuilding the Balkans. And then he was hauled down to Albania and given a good working over by various people, and he changed his line. And the United States then submitted to this idea of developing this Albanian entity as a new destabilization factor for the Balkans. So yes, there is an attack on Macedonia. There's an attempt to destroy it, no question. But we have to see it for what it is. We have to see this as part of the same pattern. Remember, Europe was destroyed also, continental Europe, by the Gulf War, drained the resources of Europe at a critical point. The Balkan Wars have drained the resources of continental Europe throughout the entire period since the close of the Desert Storm War. The continuation of the Balkan Wars is sucking the blood out of Europe from the underbelly of Europe. We see what should happen there as opposed to what's happening. The Middle East war is part of the same thing. All of this is one gigantic geopolitical strategy. Balkans and Middle East. Balkans and Middle East. It's the old game of the French and the British and the Ottoman Empire playing the same game all over again. Control the world by controlling the Ottoman Empire factor. Middle East and Balkans. Middle East and Balkans. It's an old story in Europe. Those of us who know anything know that. I'm afraid that George W. Bush doesn't know anything about this sort of thing. I don't think he got through the first grade. I think he was sort of kicked out of Yale instead. But in any case, so don't blame him too much for it. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But the point is that those behind the Anglo-American force, which actually is NATO, NATO is not an alliance among European nations. That ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union. NATO became a tool of an Anglo-American imperium, a bunch of bankers in New York and London and elsewhere, who are trying to run the world through globalization, looting and destroying, managing by great power politics, the same way the Balkan Wars were managed in the past. And that's what the whole game is. When we realize that that is the game, and that what we have to do is eliminate an IMF World Bank consortium, which is nothing more than a mechanism for establishing a world empire, and restore what John Quincy Adams called a community of sovereign nation states. We could solve this problem immediately. Just get the nations involved, say no cutting up of borders, no division of territory, no microstates, existing borders are sacrosanct. Now let us meet as sovereign nation states and work out a policy which is based on the common interest in economic development and security for the entire region. If the United States and some other countries would do that for the Balkans, it would work. There would be problems. There would be hatreds. But we should do what Henry Kissinger says don't do. Henry Kissinger says the Treaty of Westphalia was bad. Well, Henry Kissinger probably never read the Treaty of Westphalia. But the Treaty of Westphalia is a model for ending religious war and similar kinds of ethnic conflicts in Europe. It's the strength of European civilization. The nations of this part of the world, who have many ethnic conflicts in the past, religious conflicts, we must apply the principle of the Treaty of Westphalia to bring together groups of nation states who will henceforth respect each other's sovereignty and realize it is wiser to cooperate in the common interest than to fight over special interests. Thank you.
You have been listening to EIR Talks. To replay the show or to read the transcript, visit LaRouchePub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.